What is going on in El Salvador in the light of an eyewitness testimony, which is given by Dr. Charlie Clemens in this particular documentary. We're kind of a large group, so I don't know that we'll have time to introduce ourselves to each other, but I think we've been doing that kind of along the day. We're an international group, where I know that much, looking around. We're also a group of people who in various ways have been involved or at least interested in Latin America. For instance, just a show of hands, how many of you have been to Central America, have traveled there? Raise your hands high so everybody can see. Okay. How many of you know Spanish? Sorry, half my hand. Okay. How many of you are from Latin America?
Lots
of hands. I had to throw that in. How many of you feel you're fairly well informed about what's happening in Central America? Okay, there's some hesitation there. Okay, well, we should be doing some clarifying on this issue now in terms of what is going on. I just like to set this up a little bit with some history of El Salvador. There are some dates that really stand out, I think, for all of us. I have yet to meet somebody in the last decade who can't remember where they were when John Kennedy was killed. That was sort of a date that around which we attach other events in our lives, or where we were perhaps when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. I think another date that has become really important to us, especially those of us who work in the Hispanic community, is March 24th of 1980, which is the date that Archbishop Oscar Romero was killed as he was celebrating Mass in San Salvador. And of all the many tragedies, it's a tragedy that anyone dies, but it was also a tragedy in a special sense for the country, in that he was always been a voice of Christian compassion and reason in the midst of escalating violence. He was very consistent. He started out as a very conservative priest who, when he became bishop, which was, I think, part of why he became bishop, but in the process of being bishop, he became very radicalized by what he saw going on and how he interpreted the situation. And he very frequently denounced the military repression, and he pleaded for land redistribution and for unification in the country. And many people saw him as the hope for that actually becoming a reality. And so part of the tragedy was a lot of people's hopes for the possibility of a peaceful solution in El Salvador. I think we all know there is a civil war going on in El Salvador, and more than 500,000 Salvadorians have left their home, not by pure choice, but by fear for their lives and for other circumstances that they feel threatening to them. In Los Angeles, where I'm from most recently, there's a tremendous Salvadorian community who keeps that alive for us, the reasons why they are there. One of the things they remind us of is the fact that no real political refugee wants to be here. We sometimes think that everybody wants to come to the United States. They don't. But there's a real sense of a need for survival that brings them to this place. Because disappearances and murders have continued over the last few years in a really incredible way. And even though we may think the issue is confusing to us, what's happening there, a lot of the documentation is pretty clear. One of the things that needs to be stated, I think, pretty clearly is the fact that, I don't know the statistics for all years, but I know in 1983, the Human Rights Office of the Archdiocese, called Tutela Legal in San Salvador, documented that there were 67 known civilian deaths that they attributed to the FMLN, which is the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, which is the group that is fighting against the government. And in that same year, there were 5,142 civilian deaths that were attributed directly to right-wing death squads and Salvadorian government troops. And you know, those are just the ones that are documented. Many more people have died. But that is a fact that these sort of things are happening. El Salvador is the smallest country in Central America. It's the most densely populated. People have said it's walled, border-to-border people. You can't go anywhere and not be with people because there are so many there. There's about a little over 5 million people in an area, the space of which is the state of Massachusetts. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine, especially up here, you know, where you can walk and not see anybody. And also, one of the things that's very similar with other Latin American countries is the fact that a very small percentage of those 5 million people own the majority of the land. which means there's a lot of landless, a lot of poor, a lot of unemployment in that situation. Just briefly, a little history about El Salvador. I think the last century, there's been a lot of buildup for what's happening today that's important to remember. And one of the things that we perhaps don't have the luxury to do here is to always learn the history behind what's happening in places that we're involved with. In 1880, there was a big coffee boom. And what happened at that time was a sociological change, too, because the elite began to suppress the communal land ownership that was traditional in that area, and to take because it was very profitable. And they began to take that land for themselves. And they evicted the peasants, or else they let them stay, but to work for very low wages. And they developed a very highly trained police force to enforce that kind of a system. And this plantation economy, as it grew up, began to include sugar and cotton. And the coffee barons really ruled the banking sectors of the as well as the government. In the 1930s, the Depression also affected them because of the crops that they had, and that prosperity was cut into, which of course always undermines a little bit the power. And so in 1931, there was a coup, a military coup, where a general, Maximiliano Hernandez Martinez, was placed in power. And that was the beginning of 48 years of military rule. And during that time, it wasn't just the military ruling. There was also a lot of labor unrest and a lot of organizing going on around among the peasants, who were still rather distraught about the whole series of events that had made them landless and had exploited them economically. One of the things that was organized is in 1932, a regional federation of Salvadorian workers, which included 10.5% of that entire economic population. And they became very strong. But there's one point in Salvadoran history that really is engraved in people's minds and without which we can't really understand a lot of things either. And that's in 1932, Farabundo Martí led an uprising against the government. He organized the peasants and led them in this uprising. And it was such an incredible thing. 30,000 campesinos were killed in this uprising of, I forget how long it lasted, whatever duration. But I mean, 30,000 peasants were 2% of the population of El Salvador. And one of the things that we don't know, and we may think we had nothing to do with that, and if you want to be legalistic, we could say, well, we had nothing to do with that. But every Salvadoran knows that during that uprising, when those campesinos were being killed, U.S. troops were in battleships right off the coast while this was happening, poised, as it were, for whatever help might need to be provided, which was not provided. But the fact that they were there has left an indelible impression on the Salvadoran people. And they know that part of history, which probably very few of us do. I certainly didn't until this year. You know, I like history and I read all my history books, but that was never considered to be an important part of our history. Martí became a martyr, and the whole feeling of the campesinos didn't die, that need to restore to them lands that were theirs, and that need for a dignified way of life. And that's why the major opposition group took on the name of Farabundo Martí in honor of his heroic efforts. In 1932, there was a government coalition developed, and it was not really very radical at all. It did talk a little bit about some moderate land reforms, which were nothing to really get excited about, except if you were a big landowner. And they got very excited about that, and eventually set up a fraudulent election. It culminated in a lot of things, but in 1977, they had an election which was notably fraudulent. And the military put into power another general, Romero. And at the beginning of his particular rule in El Salvador, there was really established a whole reign of terror. And I think it's hard for us to comprehend that, too, and it's probably unpleasant for us to comprehend that. There were a number of right-wing death squads. One famous one was the White Warriors Union. That just set out to totally destroy any opposition. If you were the leader of any group, whether a church group or whether a political group, you were instantly marked for death. During this time also, the church began to be involved as one of the targets of these death squads, because the places in where the church was involved with poor people and encouraging them to respond with for what they felt was right were also targeted as undesirables and subversives is the word. the famous word. And they were labeled communists because they organized the people. There was another coup then in 1975, and there were a couple of civilian sort of juntas that were put in place, but they were always very closely linked with the military. It was as if the military needed somebody up there to look like things were going well and were going to be better. But the facts and the statistics don't show that anything changed because the death toll still mounted and the exodus of refugees still continued, and the horror stories were still being told. There were, from like 1980, I think for 4 years, to 84, there were over 38,000 documented deaths in El Salvador. I think it's really, you know, if that happened in our country, I can't, we call that a devastating thing, and this has been going on for so long. In 1984, another civilian president was elected, José Napoleón Duarte, one that was relatively pleasing to Washington. He was sort of a moderate, and that was something that Washington hoped would look good to everybody and somebody they could support. The hopes that have been placed on him in terms of improving the situation haven't really been shown to be viable. There has not been a great improvement in human rights in El Salvador. There's been some decrease in the number of deaths recorded, but when you're dealing sort of in industrial quantities, you know, it's quality of life. One or two is pretty important, too. When you ask Salvadorians why this persecution is going on, why the death squads are doing this, none of the people I've known, the refugees I've talked to, have said, well, basically for two reasons. One is because we're studying the word, and we believe it. And the second is because we're organized. And both of those are threats to the power. If you study the word of God and you know where your authority comes from, you're a threat to anybody other established authority. If you're organized, there's the potential for you causing trouble. And both of those have been very undesirable. In our history, the U.S. has always consistently been aligned with that small oligarchy who owns most of the land. There's always been that friendly relationship. And that's why with the masses of the Salvadorian people, there's not a great understanding or love for our government and the relationship that we've had. And that's why it's important for us, I think, too, to look at the situation. We're constantly presented with acts in Congress to give money. We have given millions of dollars in military aid to El Salvador. We've trained over 2,000 to 3,000 Salvadorian military troops. I just read the other day, I read a story of a soldier in El Salvador who was drafted and who explained how he'd been trained to torture by 8 to 10 Green Berets who were sent down to train them. And it's the sort of thing you read, you can't stop reading because, you know, you're just amazed at the creativity of people, and at the same time, you can't help feeling horrendously sick at the appalling disregard for life and a gnawing uneasiness, which is, putting it mildly too, of the fact that somehow we're attached to that in a very unhealthy way, in a very immoral way, in a very unchristian way. And that's why I think, probably for my part, and I think for all of us in this country, we really need to look carefully at what's happening and to not be involved in those things that we would never, in our right minds, applaud or support. So that's why, and nobody can tell the story better than somebody who was there also. The man who's in this film, he'll explain a little bit who he is Dr. Charlie Clements. I heard him speak last summer, I think. He has done some speaking as the Sanctuary Movement has requested people to interpret the situation. He's a former U.S. military person who has become a Quaker, a pacifist. And he's a doctor. One thing I learned about pacifism somewhere in the last number of years is that pacifists are not passive, especially Quaker pacifists. They're very active. And part of his journey was to find out what was happening to serve the Salvadorian people, not the troops of anybody fighting, but the people themselves, and especially the children who are suffering horrendous traumas also as they live out the situation of death and violence in their country. So that's basically what I would like to say about this. I think it's about half, I can't remember, it's about half an hour. It's an Academy Award-winning documentary that this year, I think it won. I don't know, has anybody seen this yet? Probably you have. I found it really fascinating.
When did it get produced?
Last year, perhaps? It must have been last year if it was up for nomination this year.
Doesn't it portray events when he was there, which was about 82?
Yeah, he...
So it's a bit out of date in the sense
right.
that is there continuing documentation of same numbers, if not that I'm trying to minimize the problem, but since Duarte's been in, hasn't there been some document decrease in the numbers of right-wing causes?
Yeah, in the first year or so that he was in, it was no decrease. It was exactly the same. The recent year, there's been some decrease in the numbers. And as I heard it explained to me recently, those numbers also may be very much deceiving in the fact, when you consider how many are already killed and how many have left the country, it's almost natural the numbers would go down as the people are pushed down. But yes, there has been a decrease of, I don't know, a couple thousand a year. But we're still talking about thousands of people, so that's true.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to talk at all about the role of other countries in El Salvador, Cuba, USSR?
Yeah, we can talk about that afterwards. Yeah. But I think we should see this. And
language and graphic images that are adult in nature, parental discretion is advised.
November 26th, awaiting an invasion. That seems to be a large part of the nature of war in El Salvador. This time it seems a little more serious, as the people are preparing to evacuate. Everyone has prepared bundles of food and clothes to carry. The people here give me strength. They're calm and courageous in the midst of potential disaster. We have to keep them well hidden in the day. If the spotter planes that buzz overhead to see a concentration of people, they'll call an airstrike or fire their own white phosphorus rockets into our midst. There was one baby born en route. I saw her a few hours later. What strength a mother. She kept right on going afterwards. Later in the evening, I had my radio turned to a Salvadoran station that played Christmas carols. It seemed rather bizarre in the midst of all this. I thought I knew what I was bargaining for when I made the decision to go to El Salvador. I knew that over 40,000 civilians had already died as a result of violence, that 25% of all children died before age 5 of malnutrition-related causes. I was as well prepared as anyone could be. I had grown up with a sense of service. I was a distinguished graduate of the Air Force Academy, and as a Vietnam veteran, knew a little bit about a combat zone. But I couldn't help but wonder what I, Charlie Clements, was doing as a doctor in the front lines of the war in El Salvador. The physicians or nurses who treat patients with wounds are considered subversive as well. So you can't buy gauze in San Salvador. We began using mosquito netting because people buying gauze came under suspicion. And then people began disappearing and bought mosquito netting. And then we began buying diapers. Before I left the front, a woman who was coming back on a bus was taken off of a bus because she didn't have the election stamp and her ID card that made her suspicious automatically. The soldiers demanded to know why a poor peasant would have cloth diapers in her bag, and she didn't have an adequate answer, and they knew they were used for gauze, and she lost her life as a result. I'm not talking about some area off in the jungles. I was 20 miles from San Salvador. I could see the hotel the journalist stayed in on a clear day. When I went there 2 years ago, I went there because I feared that another Vietnam War was developing.
I went overland, and I was in a hotel room waiting to be taken in for some time and was listening to radio reports about what was going on with them in El Salvador. I had been promised three conditions of service. One, that my medical neutrality would be respected, that as a Quaker, I wasn't going to bear arms, and that I could work with civilians. There was a particularly potent offensive against an area called Wasapa, and then the Salvadoran commander came on and said that the slopes of the volcano were on fire, and the terrorist stronghold had been eliminated, and I kind of breathed a sigh of relief, thinking, well, I won't be going to that hellhole. And then 10 days later, I found myself marching into that area, and my distinct impression was the smell of war from a long ways off, the smell of burnt flesh, the smell of fields, the smell of charred houses, which were all the result of that offensive in that area would be my home for the next year. One of my first patients was a woman with a young infant who was breastfeeding the whole time I was treating an abscess in her calf. She got a grenade fragment in her calf when she was 9 months pregnant. She walked for 3 days without treatment and then delivered her child. The abscess is now 2 months old, and we're attempting to drain it through the original site of entry that had been scarred over.
One of the first patients I came to know, as I mentioned, was Camila, who at 38 was in the midst of her eighth pregnancy. Camila told me that she had three living children, and upon inquiry said that she had had one miscarriage. And I asked her a question I would learn to ask very differently. I asked her what happened to the others. There was a flood of anguish, and she went through the litany telling me her first son died in the year of drought, and her second son died in the year there was too much rain, and it was the litany that peasants would go through who paid 50% of what they produced to the landlords or to the lenders, and who in a good year could survive on that. And in a bad year, the choices were this: go ahead and pay the landlord or the lender and watch another child grow hungry, or go ahead and feed the children one more year and then watch their land be repossessed, and watch land that had grown corn and beans and sorghum, what they eat three times a day, then be replanted in cotton or coffee or sugarcane, or be used to graze cattle. The peasants told me about what happened to them in the 60s. Patients like Camila, who belonged to a base Christian community. We might call that a Bible study group, but began to talk about something called liberation theology. In its simplest form, as the peasants said it, what they heard was that their misery wasn't the result of God's will, but was the result of a few men's greed. And it was an inspiration not to pick up arms, but to organize. And in these base Christian communities, a group about this size, they would discuss the message of social justice in the gospel. Organization like that, a change of the status quo, was perceived as a threat. And a popular slogan in the 70s was "Be patriotic, kill a priest." Any one of you for participating in a meeting like this in Salvador would be risking your life. Because first the death squads blamed the priest that brought this message, and they killed a number of them. And they came after the leaders of the cooperatives that had sprung up, because a lot of agricultural cooperatives were another result of this message. As as that happened, the sons and daughters of the campesinos that were the targets of these attacks began to respond, and they began to ambush the death squads.
Every effort at bringing about nonviolent change was met with greater and greater repression, and one just has to look at the history of El Salvador in the 60s and 70s to understand why there's revolution today. I didn't find the people who would willingly turn toward violence, but of people who were faced with no other alternative. It became an issue of survival for them.
Could you say something about your commitment to nonviolence as a Quaker and how you feel about what the guerrillas do? You know, their violence. I know you worked closely with them or amongst them. How did you kind of reconcile that with your Christian faith as you?
Well, that is a very difficult question and one that I wrestle with every day in Salvador. Would I pick up a gun and defend a wounded patient if I knew that that patient was going to be tortured by the Salvador military? I would refuse to carry a weapon, and then they would send somebody in front of me with a machine gun and somebody behind me to guard me, because they said, if you won't defend yourself, we will, because you're a precious resource. You're the only doctor we have for this civilian population. Those kind of contradictions were difficult. The hospital is just an adobe house with a small fire room at one end for cooking, a tiny room on the other end that has a bed in it, and a large main room with six beds. The only furniture is wood or bamboo. Everything is dusty. There's a porch the length of the main room. It has several hammocks and two wooden benches. In front is a small banana grove. There are only four patients in the hospital. Many come here to have bandages changed daily, but once they're well enough, they stay elsewhere. The nurses are very good about dressing changes considering their conditions. The medical situation in El Salvador was very primitive and nothing like medicine practice in this country. In an operation, I'd be pleased if there was a full team there, someone to brush away flies, someone to give some anesthesia, someone to pass instruments. Those were the realities of medical care in El Salvador.
As I began to see those patients, there were calls again, there were echoes of Vietnam as we dispatched more military aid to Salvador. I began to hear things similar to what I heard as a young man. At that time it was, if we don't stop them in Vietnam, we'll have to stop them at the Golden Gate Bridge. I was at the Air Force Academy and believed that we needed to stop them in Vietnam, and I went there to do that and learned firsthand about our involvement in Asia.
I first met Charlie in Texas at Reese Air Force Base in pilot training, and we were in the 50th Tactical Airlift Squadron, and we flew C-130s, which is a large four-engine turboprop airplane that is built to withstand a lot of battle damage and make short field landings on rough strips and rough runways. So it's particularly suited to Vietnam and all the jungle and the short mountain strips. And a typical day for us, we might get up at 3 in the morning and launch at 5 a.m. Maybe our first trip for the day would be to fly 40,000 pounds of bombs from Camel Bay down to Quinan in the Delta area. And then that might get us down to Quinan at about 8 o'clock in the morning. And we might then convert to carrying troops for 2 or 3 hours and carry troops up to Da Nang. There was something terribly ironic about us bringing, for example, new, fresh combat troops in who had just arrived from the United States, and then returning ourselves to these air-conditioned billets where we ate steak and lobster every night in the officers' club, looking at the pretty lights on the bay, and we didn't really participate in being shot at ourselves. And there were special beaches for the officers, and water skiing on our days off for free all day long. You could water ski. It was, as a major friend of mine told me, the tour of a lifetime. He'd been in the Air Force for 22 years, and he said he never had anything like this. This was by far the best tour he'd ever had in his life. We all felt the same way. But there were these times that would come when you'd be carrying, for example, a dead body that might have been in a rice paddy for 2 or 3 days, and when the smell of the body would pervade the cockpit air and drift forward from the cargo compartment in the cockpit, it became difficult to avoid you from what you were actually doing. And that proved to be a real burden for Charlie. Because of his analytical mind, he could not just shut his mind off. He would think about what we were doing, what it meant for our country, what it meant for the Air Force, the welfare of the Air Force, like a good Air Force Academy man, he had the big picture. They're always telling you to keep the big picture, think policy. He was thinking policy all the time he was in Vietnam. Well, I went to the Air Force Academy because I was groomed to do so probably from an early age. My father was an Air Force officer. My brother went to the Academy. This was also the early 60s, and President Kennedy was saying, don't ask what the country can do for you, but what you can do for the country, and it fit very well with my whole notion of service.
I know that he felt a very strong obligation to do whatever his country asked him to do. Just to give you an example of the frame of mind he was in, I just happened to find a letter that Charlie had sent me some time ago. The hippies are everywhere pleading their causes like the martyrs they imagine themselves to be. I am convinced that they are representative of nothing but themselves. He goes on to say they have rallies at noon every day, bragging about how they ran from cops, or discovered a new loophole for the draft, or to gather funds for an underground pornography sheet that provides funds for demonstration materials.
I can remember very clearly one time doing push-ups in the mud and hearing civilians over on the wall laughing at us as they often did as we were harassed and being told, grin, bear it, mister, you're going to be defending those same people who are laughing at you someday and they'll look at you with respect. I was going to Asia with the idea that I would probably defend some of these people's rights to protest and that I had access to much more information than they did and I had a clearer picture of this global threat that we were confronting. After 6 months in Asia and more than 50 combat missions, I would change my mind about our role there and my participation in it. I can't pinpoint the date, but a lieutenant in my squadron began to tell me about the Phoenix program. And it began to turn my stomach. They would often just eliminate whole villages. And then it would be ascribed to some search and destroy operation, but there were some operations like that in which there was no distinction made between sympathizers and non-sympathizers. I recall flying over large areas of Southeast Asia, sometimes in Laos, sometimes in Cambodia, sometimes in Vietnam, that literally looked like the moon. Acres of pockmarked earth right where I was flying over, and I could see an area being bombed below, and I realized even as a non-combatant, which my role was classified as, that I was certainly contributing and participating in the destruction that was going on. Said there were no combat troops in Laos.
What were the facts? There are no American combat troops in Laos.
I had classmates flying in civilian flight suits out of unmarked airplanes there. I knew we had already lost about 300 planes there at the time he said that. Those secret bases they were flying out were guarded by special forces.
Laos, we are interdicting the Ho Chi Minh Trail as it runs through Laos. Beyond that, I do not think the public interest would be served by any further discussion.
I made the decision not to fly anymore on April 30th, 1970. That was the day before the invasion of Cambodia. I had flown 12 to 14 sorties to an area near the Parrot's Peak, which was the jumping off point for that invasion. That wasn't a fully developed decision at that time. I just knew I had to leave Saigon and that I didn't want to participate anymore. I didn't know what the consequences of that decision were or how it would unfold. I knew I just had to get out and that I wasn't going to fly anymore.
I was in California, a civilian, I had been out of the Air Force about 2 weeks or a month or something like that. And about that time, Charlie came home on leave, and he visited me in San Francisco. And when Charlie came, there was going to be a big demonstration against the war. So we went to this demonstration in San Francisco State, and it was a rather unusual experience. I had been in the Air Force for a number of years. I had never been to a demonstration. We were probably three of the only people in our 20s on that campus that had never been to a demonstration before. We still had our short hair, and Charlie was still in the Air Force, just on leave. And the crowd was very unruly and not like the kind of things we're used to in the Air Force, which is in order. And I can't remember how the arrangements were made, but we were supposed to give a little talk. And speaker after speaker would denounce the war. Charlie got up. Very quietly and humbly walked up onto the stage and began speaking in a very low tone voice, the first low tone voice that had come across that loudspeaker all day, and very quietly addressed that crowd And just explained that he was a captain in the Air Force on leave. He's back in Vietnam, and he's thinking about a terrible thing. And he said it in such a way that the crowd, in my utter amazement, I still am standing this day, quieted down, and they gave him a big round of applause when he finished.
SOS Veterans could be a great strength in the anti-war movement. I also said many people were saying no in different ways. Some burned their draft cards, others asked for CO status, others refused second tours, and that my way of saying no was to fly no more combat missions.
And when Charlie refused to fly anymore in Vietnam, he was sent back to the big base in San Antonio, escapes my mind for a moment, placed in a hospital and put on a psychiatric observation because the Air Force just could not deal with someone of his caliber refusing to fly. They couldn't, the only possible explanation they could come up with for an act of that kind was that his lying must have gone on, and perhaps briefly, maybe permanently, but the Air Force could not adjust to Charlie Clemens deciding that their war was insane, and it was easier for them to say that he was insane.
When I think back to what happened, I'm not sure where I got the courage to do it. I would talk to the nurses, whom I thought were educated people, and they would say I was being hostile if I showed anger being locked up. If I didn't want to talk to other patients, I was labeled antisocial. If I didn't want to take a medicine that they asked me to take, then I was told that I would be strapped down and given an injection if I didn't be more cooperative.
When you take somebody and you take away his Air Force uniform, you take away his airplane, take him away from the role he was in, take away the jeep suit and all the fancy things that go with being a pilot, and put him in a hospital ward and give him one of these little hospital nighties to go around in, a little gown, you stripped him literally of everything that made him an individual. You know, a couple of days is a long time. He was in there many days, probably weeks and then months. That's a long, long time to think about what you've thrown away, a flying career, a future. Everything you always thought you were. His whole life, he'd been a military man. And it hurt him a lot to give all that up.
The one thing that I thought about a lot was the callousness that I had developed with regard to life itself. I remember specifically picking up the body of a good friend once and not having the luxury to mourn at all, to grieve, not just knowing that those emotions weren't possible. And after one does that enough, you begin to tune out life and begin to treat it very callously. And I didn't want it to happen to me again. And as a result, I made a personal commitment to nonviolence that would be a daily reminder of how one can become.
Hiking in El Salvador with a backpack up there. I thought it was just splendid.
There was one very poor family, a mother, two daughters, and a granddaughter, who insisted on giving us a cup of coffee en route. The woman told a heartbreaking story about how they killed her 62-year-old husband, who was hiding in a hole because he couldn't run in the last invasion. Then, using dogs, they found the holes where they had buried their food and another few belongings. They burned it all, shot the livestock, and then, to top it off, chopped down the avocado tree and the three fruit trees. She says she won't leave. I wonder about the woman and so many others living in houses with caved-in roofs from fires or bombs. There was hardly a day the last 6 months in which there wasn't either an attack by American-supplied A-37 fighter bombers or strafing by helicopters over Passover or rocketings by these observation craft. We had fringes by many of the houses, but we started an intense program of building bomb shelters. And sometimes after an attack like that, children wouldn't come out of the caves where the elderly people would just sit there in the mud, trembling.
Porque ellos buscaban los caseríos donde vivía uno, tirándole. Y él salía a ver, pues después del bombardeo salían a ver ellos los grandes hoyos que hacían, como piscinas servían ya en el invierno los hoyos que hacían las bombas. Los niños los hacían pedacitos, no se hallaban los niños a veces.
Día y noche, pues lleva la tierra. Entonces, ya él pues ya tiene ahí su ejército, que ya no sale de WhatsApp. Y entonces nosotros, cuando logran ellos localizarnos a nosotros, pues sí, porque lo que muere son los niños y los ancianos. Y uno así pues, pero uno sabe que no tiene cómo defender. Lo que morimos somos nosotros, y los niñitos y los ancianos, como ya no pueden caminar.
White phosphorus was used practically every day the last months I was there because of the observation craft using it as a primary anti-personnel weapon. It has particularly devastating effects because of the temperature with which it burns. Muscle fat and other deep tissue is instantly coagulated, and it becomes embedded in tissues and often smolders, even reignites long after initial trauma. So it's a particularly horrible anti-personnel weapon. I think it's particularly ironic that when Charlie was down there in this Gaddafi front region, he was being bombed, his area was being bombed, every day by A-37s, which are the combat version of the T-37 that Charlie and I both flew, learned how to fly down in Lubbock, Texas in 1967. So here we are 15 years later, and a man who came from a military family, had nothing but the highest and finest military ideals and tradition, has come full circle from sitting in the cockpit with his oxygen mask and his helmet and flying this A-37, T-37. 15 years later, he has ended up with a backpack down in this jungle, down in El Salvador, getting bombed by the airplane he used to fly.
As I left the Guasave front, some of the people there asked me why it was I didn't carry a gun. And I was talking a little bit about what it meant to be a Quaker, because most of the doctors there carry guns, and about violence and nonviolence. And one of the campesinos looked me in the eye and he said, shook his head and he said, "You gringos have some real strange conceptions of violence." He said, "You're real worried about what gets done with machetes and machine guns." He said, "I worked on the hacienda over here, and I would have to feed those dogs bowls of meat or bowls of milk every morning, and I could never put those on the table for my children." And he said, "When my children were ill, they died with not simply from the landlord, but when those dogs were ill, I took them to the veterinarian in Suchitoto." He said, "You will never understand violence or nonviolence until you understand the violence to the spirit that happens from watching your children die of malnutrition." And that's what the issue is about in Central America today.
That particular comparison may strike all of us, but it was sort of incarnated in his life. He lived that, mm-hmm. And it was a natural comparison for him. Yeah.
Is he still down there?
No, he is back in this country now. He was there for a little over a year. He has gone back since then. And I'm not sure where he is actually based right now.
A lot of medical people still going down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are people going down. I don't know how many.
Would you agree with this last statement that hunger is the main issue? If I remember the last sentence, he said that that is the issue of the children dying. Because, well, not hunger, but greed.
Yeah. Okay. But what he said was the idea of violence to the spirit,
right,
is what it's all about. And I would say hunger is part of that violence to the spirit. So I'd say that, yeah, I would, under violence to the spirit, I'd put any form of injustice that strips people of their dignity and right to life as human beings. And yeah, I would say that's true. I would. And I think it was really good for him to point out that concept of violence, too. you know, I've been raised in a culture that says, you know, you speak nicely and you don't overtly hit people, and yet we tend to overlook violence that's systematized in an institution, and that same violence that kills people's spirits. It was mentioned yesterday when we were talking about Latin America. What do you do with, what hope is there in crushed spirits? And there's hope. Yes.
I think what disturbs me the most is that El Salvador has disappeared from our news media, and we're not told what's going on down there.
You've noticed that. Yeah, that's very disturbing to me too. That it's almost like he says too. We get so immune to the statistics, like, you know, 1,000 this year, 900 next year, and, you know, oh, things are getting, yeah. But that, just that, and I think one thing this movie brings out is that human dimension that I can't imagine. I don't know of any family I could even think of that in El Salvador would not have some of their family touched by this violence, either killed or disappeared or something. And if you look at it in those terms of relationships, it's an incredible, you know, situation. But yeah, the need for news is something that...
The film showed the fact that at the time of the Vietnam War, President Nixon obviously lied about what was happening. I think the implication that the film is trying to leave is that maybe that same thing is happening now. Do you feel that is really the case? That our administration is not really telling the whole story?
Yes, I do.
They have a tape recorder on
though. Yes, I do. yeah, and there are a lot of ways that could be described. Tomorrow we're going to do some sharing also of a trip that the Erlanders and Joe and I took that included Nicaragua. We had some conversations with U.S. government people, and that was very enlightening on that. But yeah, I hear news from people who come from El Salvador, people who are now in El Salvador who send news out, and it often is news that is not presented anywhere in our newspapers. It's often news that's very contradictory to what we hear, or things we simply do not hear. I mean, that's what I've experienced in the...
Why would our press not want to dig into the whole story, the facts that are there, since we pride ourselves on having very aggressive press? Yeah, it doesn't seem that they're really being as aggressive in that situation.
Does anybody have any?
It's not a popular issue, I think.
Yeah.
It's not an American issue.
It's old cell newspapers.
Well, that's it. It's old news, I think.
It doesn't sell newspapers and it doesn't sell TV.
Mm-hmm.
So the news doesn't cover it.
Yeah.
From what I've heard from people in Europe, we have terrible press. One of the worst presses in the world.
We have the best weather reporting there is, though.
We do. Everywhere.
But I thought the film, to me, the film left me very confused.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't answer any of the questions that that have come to mind as a result of reading the newspaper and trying to understand what's going on. Is the El Salvador situation, the Nicaraguan situation, a civil war which has the United States and Cuba and Russia and who knows who else involved in it in some way, giving arms to different groups, making the situation even worse? Or what is it? What's happening? This shows me what is clear if you look at the papers or television or anything else, the suffering of the young people and old people and the bombings and everything else, but it doesn't give me any idea of what's really happening in that country in terms of why it's happened, what's the history behind it. You went into that.
That's why I did some of that at the beginning, because I think that's really critical, and you're right. You can look at a situation and say, oh, there's trouble here. You know, why is there trouble? Is it because somebody's in there causing it? Is it because there's a legitimate reason for there to be trouble? You know, those are legitimate questions.
Could you sketch out again what the various factions are?
Okay, well, very simplified, because my experience also in Latin America has been that there are incredible number of groups. When I was in Chile, there were, you know, a dozen groups to the left and a dozen groups to the right and, you know, a few groups in the middle. And in our country, we tend to report, you know, right, left, and there's nothing else. And so there are a couple, well, there are some principal characters in this drama as it unfolds, and some subgroups too that I'm not that familiar with personally. The one that's most well known is the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, which is the most organized opposition to the government. They're the ones that have the most press. And again, they base themselves on that history of Martí leading that peasant uprising against the unjust dictates of the oligarchy at that time. And they take their hope from also other martyrs in recent years, of which there are a long list. And then basically there are the government, the military in El Salvador, from everything I've been able to understand, is the most incredibly organized and powerful and brutal force of any of the countries in Central America, which is one reason there's been no government that has not been controlled by them or had to give tremendous concessions to them in order to be able to exist. And whenever they did something unpopular, they would just, you know, replaced with somebody else. And that's a pretty much, Latin Americans who analyze the situation say that there is very little hope for change unless that whole military structure is restructured and some of that is taken away. There are a lot of right-wing death squads, that some of which have some connection to the government, some of which, I don't know, they're connected to, well, a lot of them are connected to that oligarchical structure, who really operate on their own. And where most of the terror actually comes from, as far as has been documented. Just the incredible number of, well, El Salvador right now is just a land that's, you know, the blood comes from the tremendous number of murders and rapes and mutilations. And we're not just talking about shooting people, we're talking about dismembering them and putting them there to scare other people from organizing against the government. And it's that kind of a force that is looked upon by the great mass of the people as something that's really not doing anything to benefit the country. And so I think one of the things that I would need to say about this too is we do a disservice. A lot of times we look at that situation and we try to figure it all out by ourselves without adequate information, for instance, like history and things like that. And one of the things I think is a great indignity that we do is that of looking at other peoples as objects, either of our concern or of our manipulation or of our, you know, using them as pawns, like we're engaged in a struggle perhaps against Russia, therefore we play that out on somebody else's turf. And I'm always terribly offended by the phrase, you know, they're in our backyard. It is not our backyard. It is their home. And they are our neighbors, but it is not our backyard. And they may be close to us, but just that whole way of sort of defining other people's reality in terms of our own possessiveness is something that makes us very unable to go into a situation and offer anything except more confusion perhaps to that. And so what I usually say too that's important to me and has always been important to me, and sometimes I think I see things really well, but I still need to check that out with the people who are directly involved. What do the people of El Salvador want? It's not what we want in El Salvador, it's what do the people of El Salvador want. I'd say probably, you know, 95% of the people would not want war. You know, that's probably a very safe guess. And what we also get in this country, you know, whether or not we are all, as, you know, some things are really clear to me, but whether or not things are clear to us, I think that need to listen to those people, you know, not as people who are there to be used by us or acted upon by us, but as people who are, you know, children of God in their own right, is to listen to what they ask for. You listen to the bishops there. They tell us, they ask us not to send any more arms. They say the arms that we send are only fueling this violence. It's not solving the violence. They tell us that there are peacemaking efforts. The only hope in El Salvador is through negotiation, and they have regional groups that will set that up, and they say, if you want to use some kind of influence, influence the negotiations. Don't influence the murder. You know, don't help that to happen. And you know, that's been pretty much unanimous among church people I know there, and among others who are intimately involved in this in their own flesh and blood, people who have families there who've lived through this violence. And I think the least we owe people in this situation is respect for those decisions. And besides that, I have other views on, you know, my own particular feelings about our acting in that way. But you know, if it comes down to choice there, it's a matter of respecting perhaps what they said. And I just wanted to show, there are some books that do study guides. I know David Baker told me we have this Crucible of Hope for sale that is a study course for congregations about Central America. Also, I just wanted to share, there was a consultation by Lutherans in Mexico City in December, ALC, LCA, AELC, Latin Americans and North Americans. And they put out a statement after their consultation that had eight things that they wanted to ask us. And there's one thing about this that is a result, something that came out of dialogue, the conferences on justice and justification. Lutherans always have a lot of concern about justification. It's sort of a big thing in our theology. And in Latin America, justice is a major issue because that's what they're living and dying for. And the question of putting these together, I think, was no accident, but is a point of departure for dialogue.